We just have a simple recommendation now to approve. I was very gratified by the work that came forth from those groups, and thank goodness we were didn't think we were so smart that we could actually develop the values ourselves. So what we have here as a recommendation is something like the following. That the following shared values, the one that you have seen up on the screen as well as the chart, will guide our work together, recognizing that all the values suggested in the discussion group reports are important to some members, and that this set of shared values will be adopted today and may, of course, at any time be reviewed and changed. Are you in agreement with that principle? Okay. Thank you very, very much. It is my pleasure now. We are just doing, all 160-some of us are doing marvelously well. We've accomplished a lot of work, and we're right on time, right on schedule. So it is my pleasure now to turn the session over to Ken Carty, who will start the learning phase.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Yes?
I just wanted to ask, is it okay if we boot up some laptops to take notes here, or does typing bother anyone?
Anyone have a problem if other laptops are running? I don't think so, no. So go ahead.
Thanks.
Feel free. It's a great pleasure for me to have this opportunity. When Jack asked me to work with him, I was, really a little dubious and a little bit unclear that I would be able to do this. And I'm absolutely delighted that smarter people than I prevailed and I've agreed to join it. The whole exercise is really quite exciting. It's a little daunting. But I think that over the next months together, we're going to have some fun. I noticed in some of the groups this morning that people kind of went around the room and introduced themselves and said a little bit about who they were. And I thought, well, it's only maybe fair then that I should say a little bit about who I am. I grew up in Montreal and as a consequence, I've become a lifelong Montreal Canadiens fan. I think it's one of the distinguishing characters. I know Sam is also, see, everywhere we are. And we don't have a secret handshake, or if we do, we're not going to tell the rest of you about it. I then went to the University of New Brunswick, where I became a forester. And I graduated in forest engineering. And through a kind of whole series of kind of odd channels, really mostly because I wanted to stay a student and not go out into the cold world, I ended up becoming a student of economics and political science. And some years later, I was offered a job at the University of British Columbia. Almost 30 years ago now, and my wife and I talked about it and said, well, let's go out there for a year or two and see what it's really like out there. And, of course, we haven't left. This is not a province that's easy to leave. And like all of you, I have a kind of devotion to it. And it's, in some sense, it's that devotion that's really was the key factor in agreeing to do this. Because I think that if I could help in any way a group of 160 fellow citizens engage in this kind of process, well, what could be better and what could be more challenging? Just a couple of introductory comments by way of background before I start. You will have been provided with a blue binder in which you can keep handouts and notes and other materials used during this phase, and there's lots of space to put in notes of your own, other materials we've provided. There is in the binder an outline of the sessions that we've planned for the next 6 weekends for this phase of the Assembly's work. There's a fairly detailed glossary, kind of dictionary of political terms and legal terms at the back. And the reality is that some of the kind of terms we will deal with do have kind of precise and legal meanings, and it's important that we're all using the words in the same kind of way. So we hope that will be helpful to you. It's also on the web, and you can find it there as well. You have in your binders or in a plastic sleeve that came along with it some kind of outlines for the first couple of sessions, for the first two today and the first one next weekend. And you can put them in the binder and make notes on them, scrawl on them as you like. We haven't provided the materials for further sessions yet because we wanted to see how these ones worked, whether they seemed to be what you kind of needed, whether they kind of summarized it, whether they were helpful guides. And so any kind of feedback and comments on that will be useful to us in deciding whether this is the sort and amount and character of material that can be helpful. We've also provided a reference book. Well, it's a textbook on electoral systems, but we think it is the best textbook that there is available. It's written in an unbiased and clear way. There's lots of description, but inevitably it's complex stuff, some of it. So there isn't going to be a test at 3 o'clock, despite the rumor, on the first four chapters. Some of you will, I'm sure, devour it. Others of you will use it as a kind of reference. We'll dip into it. We'll look at illustrations or examples. But it gives us a kind of common basis that we can work from, and you can use as a backup reference as you like. For all of us, this is going to be complicated material. For some of it's new material. For some of it's more familiar. The important point to note, of course, is that we don't have to decide at the end of this afternoon about any of the details of this stuff. We're going to start with the general principles and work towards the details. And as I said to some of you in selection meetings, the devil will be in the details, and we will get to the devil before we're done, but there's no rush to meet him. And so we won't do that for a week or two. We don't have to make decisions today. We don't have to make decisions this month. We have to try and develop ideas and concepts and debate about the principles that will guide us to the kind of decisions we'll make eventually. So we want to absorb the ideas, think about how they connect to our values, talk them over in the kind of terms that Susanna's just been referring to. In this phase, we're going to have presentations in this hall, but we're also, I think, really going to do a lot of the serious work in the discussion groups, talking about the material, arguing about it, thinking about it, talking about the implications, voicing opinions, asking questions, hearing what other people think. If you've got questions in this assembly, certainly feel free to ask them. We have limited time. There's more time in discussion groups. One of the reasons we have discussion groups is, in some sense, we increase the amount of time we can have because we can break it into pieces, if you like. But feel free to ask questions here or there. You've met the discussion group leaders. They're all exceptionally able young graduate students, and they're really here to help keep the discussions going, to answer questions, to provide backup. And let me just say finally that at the end of every weekend, we will ask you to fill out a very short evaluation form, largely because we want to know whether the kind of materials we're going to be providing are working for you. And so there'll just be a few tick-off questions. Were the general presentations helpful? Was the kind of material you had useful? Did the discussion groups work? What worked well? What didn't work so well? Write comments on them. And we're using that kind of feedback, we can modify and change the program. As Jack said this morning, this has never really been done before. No one's ever tried to discuss these kinds of issues with 160 citizens chosen at random with different interests and different backgrounds. And so we're not really sure what will work and which will work, what things will work better than other things. So tell us. Nothing is written in stone, and we'll be happy to try and modify as we go along. Well, so maybe we should start. I'm wondering how many people are here because they really, really, really want to learn about how the Australians elect their Senate. Or what the South African ballot paper looks like. Nobody. Well, I didn't actually think that's why we were here. Most of us, I suspect, are not even here because the prospect of a free political science course on election law was just too exciting to pass up. Now, you know, in my day job, it's what I do, and I would have hoped there might be one or two who would think, you know, I can't pass that up. But again, I don't really think that's why we're here. I think we're really here because we, deep down, at the end of the day, care about this province, this peculiar, special, wonderful province of ours. Because we think that as citizens, that's a remarkable word, as citizens, we have a right and maybe even a duty to make some kind of contribution to our collective existence and our collective work as a community. Because we think and we suspect that somehow what a healthy democracy, at the heart of that, the way we make collective decisions is absolutely fundamental to our common political life. And that, of course, is going to bring us immediately and very quickly to the whole question of elections and the processes by which we use to hold them. Because the electoral process is a process of collective decision-making on big, important issues for any society. Because at the heart of any democratic politics, or at least any big democratic politics that has been invented for a mass society that we know about, is a system of regular elections that allows citizens to make choices about the kind of government they want and the kind of people they want to run it. But we know that the kinds of choices they make The way in which those choices translate into public policy, into collective life, are very much shaped by the very way in which you make the choices. There's a kind of circle there. You want to choose, but the way you choose has an influence on the kind of choices you can make. And that's about the question about the electoral system. And will a different kind of electoral system, a different way of choosing, allow us to make different kind of choices? And if we make different kind of choices, will we have a different kind of society? Well, I mean, those are the big fundamental questions that we want to wrestle with and are important. And you know, we all know that no two societies use the same kind of electoral system. You know, there are 30 or 40 or more every year working mass democracies in the world. No two use exactly the same kind of electoral system. They devise systems that they think will work well for them, that will allow them to make the kind of decisions they want, decisions that will articulate their values. Some are pretty close. The kind of system we use is pretty much like the kind they use to elect parliaments in Westminster, but it's not exactly the same. And it's really quite different from the system the Australians use to choose their Senate, and on and on. And we know that no two systems, even when they're similar, will work the same way in different places. So we can think about other systems, we can learn about them, but we can't guarantee that if we were to adopt them, they'd work the same way here they work in other kinds of places. So choosing electoral systems is really, in some sense, about trying to think about how we make choices about the kind of politics and the kind of government we want, if the electoral system will shape that. There's no guarantees involved. So to start thinking about electoral systems, we really have to start with a conversation, a collective conversation about what kind of politics we want. What is it we're trying to do? What kind of system would maybe help us do that? What kind of society do we want? What kind of democratic political community do we want? What do we value? Well, there's lots of ways in which we could have that conversation, but it seems to me one of the ways which we can kind of practically start it today is by saying, well, where are we now? What kind of politics do we have now? We understand the kind of system. We've lived with it. We all have a kind of personal experience of it. We don't have personal experience, so many of us, about how politics is done in other places. So if we think about the kind of politics we have now, produced by the kind of electoral system, or at least produced in part by the kind of electoral system we have now, what is it we like about that? What are the things that maybe don't work so well for us in that kind of process? And therefore, it might well be worth thinking about changing. And if there's something we want to change, is there some change to the electoral system that will maybe help us do that? Well, that's really what we need to start with. So maybe starting with some of the big features of the present system is one way to begin to have this conversation about this kind of process. Well, what kind of system do we have now? I'm going to suggest that there are a range of characteristics, but there are four or five that are really fairly basic and fairly fundamental. We have a system of what we might call simply adversarial politics. And we'll talk about that. We have a system in which the government now dominates. You know, we have a theory that Parliament rules, but we know that in practice, the governments rule, the governments control parliaments. We have a system in which we elect people on the principle of geography. Politicians represent space carved out on a map, and the people, of course, who inhabit that space. But the fundamental principle is a kind of geographic one. We have a system in which the way we vote doesn't translate in any direct or immediate or obvious way into the results. Parties might win 20% of the votes and get no seats, or they might win 20% of the votes and get lots of seats in Parliament. There's no obvious or regular or systematic connection. There are reasons for that, and they're rooted in the system, but that's one of the fundamental features, and that has some real implications for the way it works. And we also have a system in which we have very simple choices. You know, you go into a ballot box, and you have three or four names, and you get to put an X beside one of those names, and that's it. So all of those are really fairly fundamental characteristics of the political process that we understand and know and have in this kind of country. Well, we want to reflect on whether these are some of the features that we think we want in our politics. Or are there alternatives? And if there are alternatives, what would be the consequences of adopting some of those alternatives? Because if we change one thing, is it likely to spill over and change some other kinds of things? And how might it do that? What would the implications of those sorts of things be? So I want to talk a little bit about these five big kind of features of our system. And then in discussion groups, I hope that people will say, well, you know, I like that part, but I don't like this other part, and how are they connected? And we can kind of think, well, are these features of the system we have now what we want? And if at the end of the day, 160 people say, those five things are the greatest things in the world, and we really like the way our politics works, and maybe we'll have an argument that we don't need any kind of changes. If there are some aspects of those we want to change, then we want to think about, well, are there ways in which the electoral system will help us do that? And that's kind of what our mandate's about. And that's why we're interested in the question of how votes turn into seats. It's not a mathematical exercise. It's an exercise that touches us at the very heart of the way we do our politics and what we're about. So let's talk a little bit about adversarial politics first. We'll go in order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 maybe. And our politics, our political process, is really, as a parliamentary process, modeled really on the court system. In fact, parliament and the legislatures are often described as the highest court in the land. And we know how courts work. Courts are worked in the principle of there's two sides of a question. There's two sides of an issue. In the court, it tends to be guilty or innocent, responsible or not responsible. They're represented in the court by the prosecution and the defense. And the assumption in an adversarial system is that one person's making one argument, the other person's making the other argument, trying to point out the flaws in the other person's argument, is that somehow out of that debate, out of that clash of ideas, I'm right, you're wrong, yes, no, will come the truth somehow. That argument and debate will force a kind of a choice. Well, that's kind of really the underlying principle of of the parliamentary system. And our legislatures are organized that way, with a government on one side and an opposition on the other side. And we talk about the loyal opposition, the capital O opposition, the capital G a government, as if there was a kind of defender and a prosecutor in the high court of the land. And they operate on the assumption if they pound the other guys hard enough, then the best solutions will appear, because one side will put forward their best case and point to the fallacies of the opposition, and vice versa. And out of that process, truth will emerge. And at the end of the day, government, the voters are the judge and the jury. They listen to the arguments. They observe the case. And on election day, here's where the election come in, they decide between those kinds of alternatives. Who has the best ideas? Who has the best people? Who has the best record? Who's best prepared to govern or needs to be removed from government? And then they can use the electoral process to choose amongst adversaries. And that's at the heart of the process. Well, it's a system that's simple and clear. It produces clear winners and clear losers. It's based on the assumption that there are winners and losers in our politics. And, of course, the idea of clear winners and clear losers means that accountability is clear. Like, we know who's responsible for the government. And if at election time you think they've done a good job and they have good ideas, you can vote for them. If you think they've done an appalling job and need to be removed, you know what to do. That's not complicated. It's straightforward. It's fairly clear. And politicians know that they're going to then be constantly challenged to defend their actions. The last election in British Columbia made that fairly clear. I mean, we all remember it. There was a lot of people who were kind of tired of the previous government. They, for whatever reason, they thought they'd done a bad job. They'd wasted money. They'd done this. They'd done that. There'd been a scandal. They came to the election, and if you wanted to get rid of the last government, you knew how to do it. It was, well, everybody in the province knew how to do it because we saw what happened. It was clear. And that is seen as, of course, one of the principal characteristics of an adversarial contest. The guy's in and the guy's out, and they hammer away at that system. Some would argue, of course, that adversarial politics has its own problems. It fosters a kind of philosophy of well, our side's right about everything, and the other guys are wrong about everything, style of political debate. Some would argue, well, you know, that's not the healthiest way to engage in political discussion, political debate, to assume everything you say is right and everything the other guy says is wrong. Where is the possibility of respectful listening or learning in that kind of process? It forces a simple for or against kind of politics. And we're all familiar with a kind of for or against a kind of framework. It's based on the principle that really politics is about creating a winning majority and winning, rather than building a winning team, rather than somehow creating a consensus and creating a broad agreement that might well go beyond a majority on what needs to be done or should be done. And, of course, it's the kind of system that works best when there are only two sides. And if you have a political party system with only two parties, as we did for many years in this country, and as the classic British system had, they have Conservatives and Labour, that works okay. But if there are a range of different parties with people having a range of different views, two-sided politics doesn't work very well if there are five players. And you could imagine a hockey game where there are five teams on the ice. It wouldn't make very much sense. I mean, the Canadians would win every time, but other than that, you know, the principle of that kind of game is that there are two sides. Well, adversarial politics is kind of like that. There are two sides, and there can be winners and losers. But if you have more people wanting to play or saying, well, I want to play, but, you know, I don't think your team is a very good kind of team. We'd rather have our own that stands for different things, that believes in different positions. It's not a system that facilitates that very easily. People in the Alliance and the Conservative Party are engaged in that kind of exercise. Well, the ex-Alliance and the ex-Conservative Party, we've seen that just in the last couple of weeks. They're coming together not because they particularly want to, as far as anyone can tell. Perhaps some of them do. They're coming together because they think they have to play the two-party game. Well, okay, so that's one of the features. Well, is there an alternative? One of the alternatives is to say, well, you know, we can have a different kind of politics, a different orientation to politics. That's consensual politics. Because some political systems operate on the assumption that politics ought to include as many views as possible. That parliaments ought to represent a broad spectrum of interests. That governments might well be coalitions of a number of different interests, so that in the government there won't be just one team that happens to have beaten the other people, but people who've created a kind of broad coalition of different interests. System designed to allow as many different opinions as possible to be represented in parliament or government. But that kind of politics often means coalition politics. Coalition politics doesn't have the same kind of sharp distinction between government and opposition. And of course, if you don't have that sharp distinction between government and opposition, accountability can be blurred. If there are three parties in a coalition in Parliament, and they've been running this government for a while, and an election comes along, and you think, well, I don't really like a number of things this government did. The first party says, well, it really wasn't our fault. The other guys made us do it. The second party says, well, it wasn't our fault. You know, the other guys made us do it. And so you can see that it's harder to pin the blame on the donkey, or the tail on the donkey, if you like, in a coalition kind of politics. That's one of the downsides. In those kind of systems, though, elections give people an opportunity to indicate their preferences, maybe. One way of thinking about those kind of elections is consensual style electoral processes allow people to indicate their preferences and to have them represented. They're not so clearly about making the same kind of choices that adversarial politics operate. They provide the possibility for people for parliaments to represent views, and politics is about representing views and articulating interests as much as it is about winning a contest. So one can see that there are different kind of orientations and different kind of trade-offs in some sense in these kind of different approaches to politics. Well, the reality is that no political system is likely to be all adversarial or all consensual. All systems have some features of both. But we do know that different electoral systems are more likely to push a system in one direction or another. The kind of system we have, the winner-take-all electoral system, pushes us in the more adversarial direction. proportional representation systems like that are pure PR systems, like in perhaps the Netherlands or Israel, tend to push in the other kind of directions. They have their pluses and they have their minuses. And so the question may well be, is our politics too adversarial, or is it about right? Is this the kind of politics that really works best? What features of consensual or adversarial politics do we want to support? Which ones might we want to modify and shape? So that's a kind of fundamental kind of set of values that's going at the end of the day to have an important impact on the way we think about electoral systems. What do we think about how politics should be? Is it about interests or is it about contests? Okay, government dominance. Well, you know, we live in a parliamentary system, and one of the fundamental principles is that we elect politicians to a legislature, and that legislature is supposed to really be the high court of the land. It's the legislature that's supposed to choose the government and keep it under control. We expect Parliament to control the government, to defeat it when it becomes unacceptable. We expect Parliament to make the laws. We expect Parliament to decide on taxes and on spending patterns, because we think we elect politicians to do these things. And in some sense, in the pure system of parliaments, that's why we elect people, to go to Victoria or Ottawa or wherever the capital is and to make these decisions on our behalf. And, of course, the theory is that by doing that, our views are going to then get represented. The common will of what we want will be put into law, will be put into the patterns of public policy. But, of course, we know it doesn't work that way anymore. Majority governments and the style of majority government that we've developed in this country means that, in some sense, we've kind of turned that theory on its head in practice. Those relationships are reversed, because majorities, which now depend on strict party discipline, means that when politicians go to Parliament, they vote the way their party tells them to, what their team decides to do in the adversarial contest. And because they do that, and they do that en bloc, in some sense, the legislature doesn't control the government, but the government that has a majority can now control the legislature. The government decides what the law is going to be and then just pushes it through the legislature. We know that from watching Parliament on television or watching the legislature, that the government decides what it wants to do, what it wants the law to be. The cabinet probably decides it. Then it comes to Parliament and says, here's a proposal, vote for it. Parliament, they put up their hands and they vote for it, and it's then a law. That is a system now in which Parliament doesn't run the country, but the government does it by running Parliament. In that kind of system, of course, opposition members are completely ignored. And if you've elected someone who's in some sense on the opposition side, on the opposition team, their voices don't get heard. Their votes don't really count, because it's all prepackaged, predetermined in the way it works. And, of course, ultimately, we know that the system operates in such a way that the premier or the prime minister comes to dominate. So it's not even the cabinet or the government that's telling the legislature what to do. It's the premier or the prime minister. Jeffrey Simpson called it, in a book he wrote not long ago, the friendly dictatorship. Sometimes it's more friendly than others. But in some sense, that's kind of what government dominance is about, and that's a reflection of the kind of parliamentary style we've had. And that's in part because of the way we elect these parliaments and the way the parties work. It can't be changed just by changing the electoral system, but the question is, what are the pluses of that kind of system? Effective, stable government, clear leadership, and so on. But what are the downsides? Well, they're the downsides of the friendly dictatorship. Whether the country goes to war or not is decided by one person. Now, we saw that in this country a year or so ago, and that's because of this kind of government dominance taken to extremes. Well, the current system, in some sense, really depends on two basic ideas. Party majorities and the existence of a majority, because if a party doesn't have a majority in Parliament, they can't push their things through. They've got to get at least some other party to agree with them. And party majorities, we know, of course, are tightly tied and to the whole business of the electoral system. And also, though, depend on a strong party discipline. So to change government dominance, we need to change one or both of those. The electoral systems can have some impact. It's more likely to have an impact on the existence of party majorities. Because majorities in the legislature, the kind of majorities we have, majority government, is a product of the electoral system. Voters in this country don't give vote in a majority for any government. Only once in the last half century have a majority of voters voted for one party in this province in a provincial election. Happens to be the last provincial election in the government we have. But in no election up till then did a majority of the voters say, we want Soak Reds or we want NDP or we want Liberals to run this country, to run this province. Only once or twice in all of Canadian history, at least since there was a universal franchise, every adult had a vote, have majorities given a Canadian government a majority. The majorities governments have are created by the electoral system. So we could change a good deal of that and would change a good deal of that. We might not want to, but we would if we changed the electoral system in different kinds of ways. So one of the at the very heart of the question of government dominance is going to be the electoral system. Whether we can change party discipline very much by changing the electoral system is a much more complicated, difficult question to answer. Some systems are likely to strengthen the hands of party leaders. Others are likely to kind of weaken it, but these are likely to be kind of really marginal sorts of differences. If we were to eliminate majority governments, governments would become much more dependent on the votes of members of the legislature. And those votes wouldn't necessarily be so automatic. The legislature then would choose the government. I mean, if no party had a majority, in effect, the legislature would be deciding which coalition of parties would form the government. But, of course, if the legislature decides who's going to form the government, that means the election isn't deciding it. Well, there's a kind of trade-off there. If you want the election to decide it, you need to have one that forces that. If you want the legislature to decide it, you have a different kind of system. Certainly in that kind of stronger legislature, the elected politicians would have a much greater role in public decision-making. And at the heart of the process, at the end of the day, would be kind of bargaining amongst politicians in Parliament. You know, the heart of the process now is this kind of competitive adversarial process. If you had a system in which no parties had majorities, the experience tends to be that at the heart of the process would be a kind of bargaining amongst party leaders, amongst politicians, as to who would be in government and how long the government might last and what the government programs might be. Sometimes that gets translated back to the electoral process. Sometimes it doesn't. So we can say the majority governments and their easy control over the legislature are in important ways the products of our electoral system. So do we like majority governments? Do we want to try and change this? What would be the consequence for our politics if we did that and didn't have a system of majority governments? Thinking about electoral systems is going to bring... This question is going to, how we answer this question is going to have an important role to play in how we think about electoral systems, because it's going to be one of the important values at the heart of the process. How important do we think that is? How much do we want a kind of politics of majority government as opposed to some kind of other politics? Okay, how are we doing for time? Not too bad. Three. Remember we had five. We've done. So we're two-thirds of the way, two-fifths of the way through. Locally based representatives. Geographic representation. Remember I said that we elect people to represent space, and in a literal sense that's true. Our system is based on the principle that we should elect people to represent the interests of some distinctive geographically defined community. That's a tradition that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years into medieval England, when people came to the old parliaments of England representing the boroughs and shires of a small rural country, when people lived in separated communities spread out across a rural society. Now, that was a system that was designed first to give voters an identifiable representative so they would know who their personal representative was in the parliament of the land. And so that when we elect an MLA, we have a face, we have a person, and he's tied to us and we're tied to him or her. It's a system which guarantees that every community will have a well-identified spokesperson in the legislature who will advocate their interests and speak for them and make sure their interests and concerns are heard by the advocates and politicians from the other parts of the province. And, of course, it's a system which ties politicians pretty clearly to their voters. Politicians know who they need, who their bosses are, who they depend upon. So there are real strengths in this system, and we all know them well. Individual voters know who they can go to if they've got a problem or an issue of concern or they want to get something on the political agenda because they have a personal representative that they've been involved in choosing. And we know that MLAs work extraordinarily hard working for their constituents. I mean, it's a function of having 10,000 bosses. Elected politicians are probably amongst the hardest working people in this land. Anybody with 10 or 20 or 30,000 bosses is going to be hard working. And every one of those bosses is important because on election day, they know that their future depends very much on that direct personal link. But like when we were talking about government dominance, we know that in practice, some of that theory has been turned on its head by the realities of party discipline. That when politicians go to Victoria, they don't go there and vote the way people in Kimberley want them to vote. They go there and vote the way that the party says, we've decided this is the way we're voting as a bloc. And it may be what the local people want, and it may not be. But you're part of this team, you're part of this party, so this is the way it's going to be. The so-called party discipline problem. And politicians increasingly depend not on all the voters or respond necessarily to all the voters in their area, but are very much tied to the voters of their party. They know who their party supporters are, and they're more concerned with them. Well, is there an alternate way to represent people in a parliament? In the 21st century, should we really still be electing MLAs on the basis of kind of space, geographic space? This old-fashioned way, some people might say. Does it make sense to carve up urban areas into a whole lot of pieces just for the sake of having different constituencies? You know, about a year ago, for my sins, I was on the Electoral Boundary Commission appointed by the Speaker of the House of Commons to redraw the electoral boundaries for the House of Commons for British Columbia. And in that process, the commission decided, well, there was going to be 5 constituencies about in Surrey, because there were that many people. Surrey was growing and it needed 5 constituencies. And we would have these hearings. People would say, well, you know, you have to draw the boundary down 36th Avenue because if you drew it down 34th, well, nobody could live with that. Other people would come and say, oh, no, the real boundary is 96th Street, et cetera, et cetera. And you kind of look at a map and you see street after street after street and you drive through the area and you kind of wonder. But we had to kind of find 5 streets and draw lines down them because we have to divide them up into equal-sized chunks for the sake of equal-sized chunks. And so one wonders, you know, do we still need to do that? Is that still the best way to do it? Might it be more reasonable to recognize that most people vote not for their locality, not for what other people in Kimberley want, but they vote along party lines at election time. And maybe they should vote for party representatives, not local representatives. Maybe voters should just choose from lists of candidates produced by parties and not worry about where the individuals live. They might all live in Kimberley or they might all live in Surrey, but since they're all going to vote the same way, does it matter? Would it produce a different kind of politics? Could individuals be selected on some other basis than geography? And there's all kinds of other social dividers in a society. Geographic space is one, but there's a host of others that we all are familiar with. Maybe some of those could be used. You know, the Irish Senate, a far more obscure place than the Australian Senate, uses kind of vocational groups, and the agricultural interests have some representatives, and the industry representatives and the culture representatives have interests, and they all get to elect senators and so on. You could do something like that, I suppose, if you wanted. But what it really does is raise the question about if we adopted an electoral system or thought about an electoral system that didn't depend on local representatives, that would allow other criteria to come forward. Well, would that be a good thing? Are we prepared to move to an electoral system in which we simply abandon local representatives? And lots of systems require abandoning local representatives, in whole or perhaps in part. Would voters lose anything of importance if we didn't have a single identifiable local representative in the legislature? Would it matter to you if you got to vote for candidates of a party rather than candidates of the place you come from? And how would it matter? Why would it matter? And how might it change our politics? And should we be thinking about those kinds of things? Well, that whole question of what's the basis for representation is the kind of fundamental one we need to think about and worry about, because there are sometimes trade-offs between it and some of the other kinds of things we need to think about. So here's a kind of whole third dimension of our politics that we want to think about. So we've got huge questions about how adversarial or consensual should it be? Questions about what do we think the proper balance between local parliamentarians and the government should be? Now we've got the question about, well, what kind of politics would we envision that would provide for a kind of basis for representation that would seem to make some kind of sense for us? Okay, the fourth question that we have to think about is the famous question of seats and votes. Because there is no predictable regular relationship between how many votes a party gets and how many seats they get in Parliament or in the legislature. Our system, and the one used all across the rest of this country, it's organized, as I say, in geographic areas. And the person that gets the most votes in the area wins. They get all the seats. There's only one to win, and they get them all. And you might have all the votes, but you might win a constituency with only a third of the votes. If there are 8 or 9 candidates and the votes are all spread apart, the person with the most might only have 30 or 40% of them. Well, you could imagine a situation maybe where there were 4 or 5 parties and the votes were kind of spread around, and one party might win a seat because it had more votes than anybody else, but it only had 35% of the votes in one riding. Maybe in the one beside it, the one beside it. You could imagine a system in which a party could win every single seat with less than half the votes, with maybe only 40% of the votes in the whole kind of system. Well, what are we going to think about a system like that? What does that kind of mean when we have a system where there's no regular connection between the seat share? Because who wins the election depends on who wins the seats, and they just add up randomly. You know, one party might win one district with 60% of the votes. A district right next door, they might win with 30% of the votes. Then another one, they lose, and even though they got 50% of the votes. Well, 49% of the votes. And so on in a random way across the province in a kind of unpredictable way. And you simply add up all those 79 individual contests that have different kind of results and see who's won the most of them. Sometimes a party can win an election even though it has fewer voters than its opponent. We had that in this province only a few years ago in 1996. Glenn Clark was our local George Bush. He didn't go to war, thank God. But his party won a couple of percent fewer votes than his opponent in that election. That's happened in virtually every province in this country. Well, it hasn't actually happened in Alberta yet, but only one party ever wins in Alberta. So, but it's happened everywhere else. We've had Canadian prime ministers elected when they had fewer votes than when their parties had fewer votes than other parties. So that can happen. We can have systems in which parties win huge majorities, even though they don't have big majorities in the vote. And when they do that, of course, then nobody can challenge them. They can run roughshod over the population. And, of course, when a party wins a huge majority, that means the opposition must be weaker than it deserves to be. If you're winning a lot of seats, then somebody must be losing a lot of seats. And so you can have a balance that's really quite inappropriate. And a parliamentary system actually won't work when one party has a lot of seats and another party has very few. Because remember, the whole principle is two equal competing parties trying to get their positions out, and it's the conflict of and competition of ideas that's supposed to, out of which the good ideas of the truth is supposed to emerge. Well, if one team has 77 members and one team has two, this is not an equal contest. You don't want to go into court with kind of one untrained law student on your side and face a battery of 53 guys from House Street on the other side. You know, that's not the way a system's going to be workable. But, of course, we have those kinds of systems. Frank McKenna was elected Premier of New Brunswick in the 1980s by winning every single seat. There was no opposition for a whole parliament, a whole legislature. Well, you might as well have kind of shut down the idea of having a democratic parliamentary system, at least as we understand it. And, of course, we know that that happened to happen in this province in 2001 as well. The opposition is so weak, it just can't do its job. It would like to do its job. The two people they have there may be competent to do their job, but two against 77 is not a system that works. And, of course, we know that small parties may not very well be represented in the legislature. There are now, at least by last count, Linda Johnson may correct me, about 34 registered political parties in British Columbia who've registered with the chief electoral officer and say they have a leadership and all the appropriate paraphernalia of political parties. A number of them won significant number of votes in the last election. But in the last election, only two of them got represented in the legislature, despite the fact that large numbers of British Columbians voted for some of the others. Does that seem particularly reasonable? So very small parties were shut out. In the last election, a party that won over 10% of the votes got nothing. But the next time they might win 10% of the seats with the same votes. It's just not predictable. The vote share you get might give you more seats, and sometimes your votes can go up and your seats can go down. And sometimes your votes can go down and your seats can actually go up. We've had all those experiences in recent decades in British Columbia. So there's no kind of regular connection between these kinds of things. Well, there are, of course, arguments for and against this kind of system. One can think of the straightforward, simple arguments for the system. People will say, well, this is what encourages two-party competition. This kind of winner-take-all system, it really means that if there's a bunch of small parties, they're going to join together because they know that they have no choice. And we can see conservatives in the alliance nationally are doing this. That's what they're doing. They're saying, well, the system is going to continue to give us a hard time if we're two small parties. If we join together, then we maybe have a chance. So the system kind of works to push people into two camps, whether they want to be there or not. Those who don't agree to play that kind of game are going to continually be discriminated against. And if you think two-party competition is good because it facilitates adversarial politics and makes accountability clear, then it's something you want to have. And, of course, we know that that's been one of the arguments for it in this country. Another argument for it is it keeps the nuisance groups out. Like all these 34 parties, you know, there are some pretty strange parties registered in British Columbia. There's a kind of millionaires party, and there's, I don't know if they have any, and there's a bald eagle party, and there's 32 others. Some of them are important groups representing significant interests in the province, but several others, you know, most of us would think, well, you know, they're going to make it a bit entertaining like the old Rhinoceros Party used to do, but really, they're kind of cluttering up the stage. And if we had a ballot paper with 34 candidates, you know, this wouldn't be very efficient or effective, and people wouldn't be able to get information and see through the clutter. So let's keep the loonies out, and this kind of system might help us do that. Well, that's a kind of serious argument. And the other argument, of course, for this kind of system that we have which is unpredictable, is, of course, that it focuses elections on a choice of government. And that's one of the ways in which this kind of system we have connects up to the adversarial process. So elections are about a choice of government. The downsides are, I suppose, equally obvious, and we've been kind of implicitly at least talking about some of them. One might argue that it's just simply unfair to those people who vote for parties or candidates that aren't represented. And if 10 or 15 or 20% of the population wants to see their spokespersons in the legislature, some of them ought to be there. Their voices ought to be heard. You know, their concerns ought to come to the wide assembly. And a legislature which doesn't hear them doesn't encompass all the views in the province. And if the legislature is going to make decisions for all of us, if we're going to be engaged in collective decision-making, then surely we want a legislature that hears those voices, in which those views are represented. And finally, of course, one argument against it is that you might well weaken government accountability to the legislature. Okay. Well, what would the alternative look like? An alternative would be something that would be more proportional. And here we get into this famous term, proportional representation. You're going to hear this term more than once before we're done. Proportional representation is just a kind of general term that means if you get one vote out of every 10, you should have one seat out of every 10. If you get 50% of the votes, half the votes, you should get half the seats. If you get all the votes, well, God love you, you should have all the seats. So a proportional representation system is one in which there's just a kind of equal relationship in terms of shares. Your share of seats in the legislature ought to be about the same as your share of votes. And some proportional representations are closer to pure proportionality than others. Some make, you know, are not quite so, but they're working in that kind of direction. Well, a proportional alternative is really, in some sense, the basic bottom line alternative to the kind of system we have, the winner-take-all system. This is the proportional system, so the winners don't get it all. They only get their share. To adopt a proportional system would mean abandoning the exclusive use of single-member constituencies. You can see why that would be, because if you have a single-member constituency and only one person is going to be elected, you can't share the seat. I mean, I guess you could say, well, you can have it for a week and then I'll have it for a week. But basically, if you're only going to elect one person, only one person can win it. If you want to share it out, you might have to say, well, okay, we're going to elect three people, and so three different parties could win a seat in that kind of constituency. That doesn't mean you couldn't have some single-member districts, but all proportional systems will mean that you couldn't have a system with nothing but single-member districts the way we have now. Right away you can see that if having a local representative is important, there may be some trade-offs here. So, like, where do those values come together? And elections are going to be focused very much more on political parties rather than on individual representatives. Because what's being measured as your fair share is your party's share. When we talk about the Liberals winning half the votes in British Columbia, we really are talking about all Liberal candidates altogether. So proportional systems tend to be much more focused on the party and defining the number of votes a group has in terms of all that the party's vote rather than on the individuals. So they are more party-focused as opposed to individual-focused, I guess, kinds of electoral arrangements. Now, there are as many different proportional representations as there are people with 23 minutes to devise a new one. We'll talk about the big families of them in coming weeks, but there's any number of ways in which you can do it, and you can alter things around the edges. And ultimately, if people were interested in a proportional system, they'd have to get in, wrestle with some of those kinds of divisions. But the big question is, do we want a system of elections that will produce a legislature that comes much closer to mirroring the voters' opinions so that the parties get about their share, or do we want elections that are much more likely to be hard choices about majority governments? Because proportional systems are not likely to be choices of this government or that government. because hardly anywhere does any one party have a majority of votes. If they did, we wouldn't worry about this issue so much, I guess. So would a more proportional system be better? And why would it be better? And how proportional would it need to be? Would it be just a little bit better be good, or does it have to go all the way? You know, in the Netherlands, and I probably will say this again, it's one of my favorite examples, if you win 2/3% of the vote, you get a seat in the Dutch parliament. I mean, it's about as pure proportionality as you can get. Other systems, you know, if you don't get 5 or 6%, you don't get a crack at the pot. So you could have more or less proportionality. It doesn't have to be absolute. So, like, how proportional would it be? How important is it? And this gets into the question about, well, do the parties that only get 1 or 2% of the vote, do we have to worry about them? You know, if we go for the principle, you know, how is it a real principle, or does it get soft around the edges? So those are questions we need to think about. How important is proportionality, and what is kind of proportionality really about, and what does it really mean, and where does it start, and where does it stop? Finally, we talked about a system that we have now that gives us relatively simple choices. We don't have much of a choice when we go into a ballot box. We've all been there. You get a list of 3 or 4 names, and you get to put an X. But when we think about what we're doing, we're making a lot of different complicated choices here. First of all, of course, we don't have much say as voters on who's on that list. Some electoral systems might give voters a lot more say on who's on the list. But assuming there's a list somehow that's produced, should elections be around just such simple choices? And after all, when we go into the polls, we do think about the personal qualities of the candidates as individuals. Are they the kind of people we want representing us? But we know they're also part of a political party, so we think about the records and the promises of the competing political parties. So now we're trying to balance off the candidates and the parties. But we also are concerned about particular issues, and maybe the parties are talking about some of the issues, maybe some other parties talking about some of the other ones, or maybe none of them are talking about the issues of concern to us. And then, of course, there's local problems that we want to factor into our decision-making. So there's a lot of different things going into our decision-making kind of calculus. But we don't get to make a very sophisticated decision. You get to make much more complex decisions when you go to the local restaurant. You know, you get a menu of things, and you can mix and match and do it in different ways. Not when you go to the polling place to make a decision to elect someone or elect a government for the next 5 years. You know, it's nowhere near as good a set of choices as you even had at lunch. So might we have all ballots that gave us different choices? And if so, what kind of choices do we want? Do we want to choose among candidates or among candidates and parties? Do we want to be able to choose among candidates of the same party? Do we want to be able to say, well, I like that person best and that person second and that person third best? You know, leadership contests allow us to choose people who engage in those among candidates of the same party. You get to kind of vote which of the ones you want. You're not just given one and say, this is our boy. Do we want to be able to choose amongst the parties instead of candidates? Saying, look, never mind the candidates. What's really important to us is to find a way to indicate which party we want in government. Because you really can't vote for a party under our system. You can vote for a candidate of a party, but it's not always the same thing. And sometimes the candidates get in the way of really making a clear system. Do we want to rank order them? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Maybe we want to say, well, look, maybe everybody should have to run with an alternate so that if they die, the alternate will just take over their seat. That will save us having by-elections. The French do that, by the way. When they elect the parliament, they elect a member. And every member runs with an alternate. And if they resign or get hit by a bus or get fed up and are no longer the member, the alternate just simply takes over. But you know who that's going to be. And if you want, you can kind of factor that into the decision. So it's a different kind of choice that's a little bit varied. Maybe you want to choose more than just one. We used to do that in big parts of British Columbia until the 1980s. A lot of constituencies had 2 members representing them. And if you wanted, you could vote for a member from each party if you thought they were the best people in your district. I have to confess I did that once. When the district I lived in had 2 members, and you know, for both party and personal and complicated reasons, I ended up voting for one party from one candidate from one party and one candidate from another party. Turned out they never voted the same way in the legislature. The whole life of the legislature, they're always on opposite sides. Well, I wasn't really surprised, but that was the kind of choices I had, and it seemed to me on that particular day the best I could do. So it was increasingly the kind of choices, changing the range of choices that voters actually have when they go to vote in important. Or will that just be so complicated and confusing that it'll discourage people? Is this really an issue we really want to think about? Different kinds of electoral systems that allow different kind of choices will have actually significant impacts on the way the parties work. You know, if parties have to nominate four or five candidates but only know that one or two of them are likely to get elected in a district, they're going to go about their selection process very differently than when they know that whoever they choose will get elected in this riding or doesn't have a chance in that riding. They can find ways to balance their tickets. They can find ways to present alternatives. They can realize, look, the voters are going to choose. They're the ones who are actually going to decide which of our candidates get elected. And, of course, that means that the party leader has much less influence over a local member. So even simple things like this, the kind of choice then kind of ricochets into the kind of parties and organizations that exist. Okay, well, I think I've just about come to my time. We want to ask ourselves, what kind of politics do we want? You can start by saying, well, what really works well in British Columbia? I mean, an awful lot must work well. We live in one of the most successful, privileged, happy, supernatural places in the world. We all know that. We're all enormously privileged to live here. So a lot of things have gone right in the way we do our politics. I mean, those people on the other side of the mountain sometimes laugh at us. But an awful lot does work well. And we need to think about what those things are and what we value and what we care about. But we also know that there are a number of things that maybe we ought to think about changing. And if a lot of people didn't believe that, and if some of you didn't think it was important to think about, we wouldn't be here engaged in this kind of exercise. So there are some big questions, and all of these things, all these aspects of our politics would be changed, some more significantly, some more profoundly than others, by changing the electoral system. So before we really kind of think about, well, what electoral system should we have, we want to think about, well, what do we want it for? What kind of politics do we want? What kind of democratic community do we need? How do we want to engage in this kind of activity together as citizens? Is our adversarial style of politics a good one? What has it brought us? What has it cost us? How much of that could we give up? What would we get if we gave it up? What would we lose if we gave it up? Do we want a system in which MLAs have more influence over the government? Or do we want a system in which the government actually gets on with the job and knows that it can plan and knows that it can operate with some kind of assurance that it'll be there tomorrow and that it can implement?